Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
America is losing the battle of the bulge. An annual obesity report released this week found 68% of adults in this country, that's 190 million people, are either overweight or obese, up from 61% 10 years ago and 15% in 1980. Children and teens are also bulking up. 17.3% are obese or overweight, up from nearly 12% 10 years ago. I'm Amy Eddings, in for Brian Lehrer. This, of course, has led to higher rates of diabetes, hypertension, and other diseases and problems related to being fat, and also higher health care costs. We have gotten fatter in the last 10 years, despite some states' adoption of stricter school meal standards, more farm-to-school programs, more weight-related health assessments for kids, sales taxes on soda, and calorie posting requirements. Why is this happening, despite a national obsession with thinness and six-pack abs? And what can be done about it? Joining me is Richard Hamburg, Deputy Director for Trust for America's Health. That's the nonpartisan advocacy group that teamed up for the report with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Richard, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I highlighted just a bit of the bad news. Anything else about the report you wanted to alert our listeners to?
Well, this is the eighth year that we've done the report and have found that obesity and overweight rates have continued to increase. And this is the first time we looked at state-specific data all the way back 20 years, and we've seen just tremendous increases in the rates, close to 200% over that period of time in a number of states.
Right. 20 years ago, no state had an obesity rate above 15%. Today, two out of three states have rates over 25%. 12 states, let's name them, Alabama, Arkansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and West Virginia have obesity rates higher than 30%. What do you think is behind the trend? I know some people think it's high fructose corn syrup, but any ideas?
A lot of factors. It's an epidemic that we've seen. We can map it out and watch the rise over the last 20 years, and there's a variety of factors. So certainly increase in high fructose corn syrup, decrease in general in the amount of exercise and the amount of movement that individuals are getting, both children and adults. We're seeing supersized portions. We're seeing people eating out far more often than they did 20, 25 years ago, and generally, and a lot of that in fast food restaurants. So it's slowly but surely we've watched this rise over a couple of decades.
Let's take a look at Mississippi. For the seventh year in a row, it has the nation's highest obesity rate, 34.4% of the population. Nine of the 10 states with the highest adult obesity rates are in the South. Is that because Mississippi and these southern states also have higher poverty rates, lower rates of advanced education, and higher black populations, all demographic profiles identified in the report that appear to correlate with higher obesity rates?
Yes, a very clear correlation between rates of obesity and overweight, diabetes, hypertension, poverty. Mississippi is the only state in the country with a poverty rate of over 20%. It has the highest rate of hypertension. It's third in diabetes. So, you know, those are certainly factors. You know, we do know that that it's related to socioeconomic status. One-third of adults who didn't graduate high school are obese, compared with only one out of five of those.
Why would education play a role, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's life's all about trying to educate ourselves on different things, and in this case, I think maybe there's more information out there, more of an understanding of what the impact is of being overweight and obese, and how it leads to various chronic diseases. It's just a very strong correlation in general between these numbers and education and income. And then there's lots of other factors that that contribute. If you look in the South, certainly the cost, the convenience of getting certain foods, cultural preferences, the way foods are cooked are certainly a factor in different parts of the country.
In New York City, we hear a lot about food deserts, places without supermarkets with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. These food deserts are prevalent in Black and Latino neighborhoods. But these southern states are more rural, with economies that are more agriculturally based. What is blocking access in Mississippi, for example, to cheap, local, healthy fruits and vegetables for these populations?
I mean, even in rural areas, you have some of the same constraints. Food deserts, although often in urban areas, can certainly be the case in rural areas with not a lot of expendable or disposable income, where one would think that that you'd have more access to fruits and vegetables, but not necessarily the case. And then in areas in rural parts of the country, even more so than in suburban areas, you're in a car. Everywhere you need to go, you're in the car. And 25-30 years ago, 3 out of 4 children walked to school. Now it's less than 1 in 4. Far greater numbers of adults walk to work or bike to work, and we've just seen overall a real trend to be less active in the school setting. The good news is that there have been greater requirements on learning and on academic achievement. The unintended consequence has been the reduction of physical education and physical activity in schools, but we're beginning to see the tide turning. We're seeing a lot of policies that you referred to earlier on in schools and the workplace as we begin to figure out how to turn this around.
I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm speaking with Richard Hamburg, Deputy Director for Trust for America's Health, which recently published its annual survey on the nation's obesity rates, and the numbers are not good. The trend continues to go up, 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 rather than down, down, down. Richard Hamburg, I've been speaking of obesity and overweight, but maybe it's good to get define our terms here. I have Jerry from Nutley, New Jersey on the line. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. My comment was, I remember in the 90s, the category of obese changed. There were those height and weight charts, and the whole standard was shifted by about 10 pounds. My weight didn't change, but my category did. Then they started counting by BMI rather than height and weight, and I'm wondering how that translates into the, sudden explosion of obesity. Everyone's now termed obese.
Jerry, good question. Richard, you want to address that?
Yeah, the definition now for obesity is a 30 on the BMI scale.
That's the body mass index, right?
Yeah, body mass index formula figuring in weight and height. Back in 1998, I believe, the federal government had defined BMI as 28 for men and 27 for women. But nonetheless, however you look at it, these rates have increased year in and year out nonstop for well over 2 decades.
So you think that these increases are something more than just a shifting of the terms of what it means to be obese and overweight?
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at New York and the statistics, so let's start in, let's look at 2000. Even from 2000 till now, we've seen the rate go up from 17% to 24.7. So, quick math, that's probably around a 40% increase, under the same guidelines just in the last 10 years.
And New Jersey, can you give me an update on how New Jersey has grown fatter?
New Jersey, the earliest figures we had here were 15 years ago at 12.3% obesity rate. Now it's at 24%, so close to a doubling over a 15-year period of time.
So what is Colorado doing right? Its obesity rate is 19.8%. On your colored map on the report's website at healthyamericans.org, I encourage listeners to check it out. It is the only state that is colored royal blue, indicating it has an obesity rate of less than 20% of its population. Is it a matter of athletic people moving there to ski and snowboard, or the Air Force base that is located there, and physical fitness requirements in the Air Force?
Well, all of these same reasons why certain states have higher rates. You know, you see the opposite in Colorado. So you look at rates of diabetes and hypertension. It's 50th in diabetes, first being the highest rate, 50th in hypertension. Low rate of poverty, high rate of physical activity. We have a statistic here. It's the second the lowest rate of physical inactivities, in other words, the most active state. So that's certainly a factor. The scary part is that Colorado's lowest, which is the lowest rate, would have been the highest rate just 15, 20 years ago. And even in Colorado, where we're looking at that state as sort of the bellwether, it's 56% obese and overweight. So almost 6 in 10 are overweight, even in Colorado.
Fabio from Manhattan, you're on WNYC with your question for Richard Hamburg. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. I want to say I saw this movie called Food, Inc., where they were talking a lot about how corn is so heavily subsidized, and nowadays pretty much 95% of supermarket products contain corn or soybean. And, you know, with all the starch and all the carbohydrates and everything that's in there, how can we expect not to become obese if almost everything we buy is contain something bad for us?
Fabio, thanks for your call. The report, last year's report from your organization, Richard, outlined 6 priorities to focus on to get results, though the report also stresses combating obesity as a long-term effort. And one of those 6 priorities was incentivize the purchase of healthier foods, reduce kids' exposure to marketing of bad foods, clearly getting the food industry involved here. But to Fabio's point, doesn't it go deeper than that? Doesn't it go to changing federal subsidies for corn and soybeans and the stuff that goes into cheap food, cheap candy, junk food, rather than just, as one of your recommendations is, to encourage grocers to replace candy and snacks at checkout aisles with healthier products?
Yeah, I think the key concept is health in all policies, that as a nation we need to look at, you know, not just the Department of Health and Human Services or even the Department of Agriculture, but we have to look at all the federal agencies, you know, at an epidemic or how they can respond to an epidemic like obesity. And absolutely true that, you know, we're tending to find that the less expensive foods tend to be the less healthy, the more expensive foods tend to be the most healthy, and you know, and the use of incentives, you know, certainly the WIC program and the SNAP program, you know, there are incentives built in now to try to get individuals to purchase healthier products. So, you know, we need to do that, but we also need to make them available. We need these farm-to-school programs. We need to address the issue of food deserts. If the only place you can shop within 3 square miles is a corner 7-Eleven that doesn't have any fruits and vegetables or healthier choices, you know, that's adding to this problem.
And yet, just putting a fruit and vegetable stand in a food desert doesn't necessarily mean that people, if you build it, it doesn't necessarily mean people are going to come. Efforts to change consumers at the store level don't seem to be working. A study of New York City's law on posting calories in restaurant chains conducted 2 years ago by NYU and Yale found people in poor neighborhoods with high rates of obesity, they found that they self-reported making healthier choices as a result of seeing the calories. But a check of their receipts showed they ordered slightly more calories than the typical customer had before the labeling law went into effect.
Yeah, you know, I think education is a good thing. Having more information is a powerful tool. How people use it, you know, that depends. And, you know, I do think that over time, policies and programs that provide more information to the consumer, whether it's nutrition labeling or caloric labeling, you know, is in the long run going to be a good thing. But, you know, we have to do what we can to make the healthy choice, you know, the easy choice. And I think that's where there's a governmental role in this. And certainly a lot of policies have gone into place in large cities like New York, where, you know, we need community-based prevention. You know, what policies and programs can we institute that can affect entire community, you know, going into the schools and looking at procurement policies and making sure that, you know, there are healthier options are available. Same thing, the restrictions on vending machines in schools. And over time, you know, it's not a silver bullet. It's a it's an epidemic 20 years in the making, but, you know, we need to do a lot of different things. Parents have a role. Individuals have a role. State and local governments have a role. Industry has a role. You know, certainly we need one of our recommendations is to make sure that the food industry is instituting some strong voluntary standards. So,
strong voluntary standards? Why not mandate the standards?
Well, I mean, certain things can be mandated, and certain things, we just need to push and cajole industry to try to do the right thing. And, there's some really strong partnerships. And, I think over time, I don't think everything can be left to be voluntary. But, what we need to do is, help build momentum on good things that are already happening in cities and towns. We're under a threat now of this perhaps being the first group of children that could possibly have a lifespan shorter than their parents, and that's got to be something that everyone has to has to really look at and worry about.
Yeah, that's serious. Aaron from Teaneck, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thank you for the program. I had a question, which is, has there been any work done to understand what habits maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago were and what they are today? I mean, obviously most of it is probably diet, but did we eat half as much meat and twice as much vegetables, and how did we work that was different? And one thing I always see that's missing, and it just works in America, is a slogan. So I'm not saying I made the slogan up, even though I did. Half as much meat, twice as much vegetables. But if that's something that actually is real and that there's data that supports it, you know, are there some factors that we could use to actually, you know, institute a better policy around those type of, analysis?
Well, I think we're in an era that people would appear to be making healthier choices, thinking about, we've had a lot of changes to remove everything from trans fats to, cook with healthier oils and low-fat milk in place of higher-fat milks. And so one would be under the impression that we're eating healthier, but we're still just eating more. The caloric intake is more than it had been. We're eating less meals at home. At home, you have a little more control about what goes in. Certainly in restaurants, even with nutrition labeling, you don't always know what you're getting. And I think that the big change has been kind of a societal change around, where we live. And 20, 30 years ago, more of us lived in communities where, kids can walk to school and can shop, a few blocks away. Now everything is, school is 10 miles out. They're community-based schools, they're regional schools where you have to drive 10 miles. You have to drive 10 miles to come home. Very few kids walk to school. We've designed communities without bike paths and walking paths. So I think now the whole idea of what they refer to as complete streets policies is important, to incorporate sidewalks and bike lanes into community design, to establish safe routes to schools. What can we do to make it safer for more kids to walk to school? And in creating incentives for mixed-use development that ends up with a community that has more people that are able to do more things, by foot.
Charles from Island Heights in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charles.
All right, how are you?
Thanks
for letting me get on this program. I was mentioning that there's an unintended or unanticipated consequence of this. Fewer people can get on a park bench. The subway gets more stuffed. And
literally,
in a hospital, to move someone of these proportions would require about four times as many people or nurses and attendants as you have now. So we're going to have to change our furniture around. And the other aspect of this, I think some of these extremely heavy people have extremely snappy digestive systems, so that they get along, they get more out of less food than most of us. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Charles. And, of course, there's also an increased healthcare cost, right, with diabetes and hypertension. Can you give me a snapshot, Richard Hamburg, of what our health care costs have been as a result of obesity?
Well, the health care costs are extremely high. We've found that obesity has resulted in close to $150 billion in health costs each year. The ability of this country to compete on the international market has become more and more difficult. The average health expenditure for a child treated with obesity under Medicaid, for example, is $6,700, while other children at $2,400. Hospitalizations of children diagnosed with obesity doubled between just 1995 and 2005. So, you know, we have a lot of statistics along those lines. And, you know, I think that the business community is understanding that worksite wellness is important, which is great, but they're also realizing that their future base of employees are coming from the community and large companies. We're beginning to hear stories that all things being equal, if we're going to locate our factory in City A or City B, you know, City A is in Colorado, City B is in Mississippi, you know, just for example, they might give second thought because they know that that's going to increase the bottom line, it's going to increase their costs. So, you know, everything is affected, higher worker compensation claims, you know, I can go down the list, you know, it's lengthy. So, you know, again, the idea that you know, one thing is going to fix this, it's not. It's everyone has a role.
Maybe the way to change behavior isn't giving people more information only. It's in shocking people, like the city's gross-out anti-smoking campaign. And yet that runs the risk of demonizing people for the way they look. You know, the tipping point with smoking came when people stopped seeing as acceptable smelling cigarette smoke while they ate, concerns about secondhand smoke and what that was doing to their health if they chose not to smoke, having somebody nearby them choosing to smoke. How is there a way to make getting fat gross, overeating gross, eating beyond one's caloric capacity gross without demonizing overweight people in the process? Is anybody thinking along those lines?
Well, you know, I think that you know, better a carrot than a stick, so to speak, and you know, anything that we can do to one, educate the public, and to prod and cajole people into being more active and eating more healthy foods is a good thing. I mean, that's the way to go. I mean, we talked earlier, you know, the eating habit, Americans' eating habits have changed dramatically. You know, now I'm looking at some statistics. It's Americans are eating 300 more calories a day than in 1985, 600 more than 1970. The portions are huge. The increases range, you know, are extreme. You know, eating fewer fruits and vegetables and whole grains. Sugar added, we talked about that earlier. The consumption of added sugars increased almost 15%.
So we just have to find a way to make this less desirable than eating a strawberry. Richard Hamburg, your organization has its work cut out for it. Deputy Director for Trust for America's Health, a nonpartisan advocacy group that co-authored its annual obesity report with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The conversation continues online. Go to our website, WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on WNYC.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Coming up, the Moroccan Spring, or is it? Stay tuned.